I refuse to testify on the grounds that my organs will be chopped up into a patty.
Ah, the 67th Amendment.
For a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
Can you see Captain Blackadder anywhere in this courtroom?
That's him! That's him! That's the man!
Ah! No more questions, sir.
Or you'll be held in contempt of this court.
I have nothing but contempt for this court.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, the podcast that pairs an inquisitive interviewer with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode number 82, and I'm your host, Thomas Smith. That over there is your main, more important, way better host, Andrew Torres. How are you doing, Andrew?
I disagree, but I'm doing great. How are you, Thomas?
Doing great. I am excited for our interview today. I love getting to speak with really interesting people on this show. Last week's interview was a hit. I thought a lot of people loved it. I loved it. So yeah. I think we're on a roll. I can't wait.
I agree. And Andrew, we're having Andrew Seidel on from the Freedom from Religion Foundation to break down the atrocious Trinity Lutheran decision. And I couldn't be more excited. I mean, Andrew does these kind of cases. So, I mean, we really couldn't have a better expert to come in.
Oh, this is one of those people on Twitter, you know, a lot of times were like, hey, talk to Andrew Seidel. Hey, and I think they were tweeting him like, hey, talk to Andrew Torres. So
right.
Glad to finally make that happen.
Yeah. I'm excited about it.
Awesome. Well, before we get to that, I know you wanted to do a little announcement just before everybody asks, because a lot of people have been asking about the Majid Nawaz SPLC case. So what are you going to tell us right now?
Yeah, we are going to cover that on Tuesday's episode. And we're going to do that for a couple of reasons. So, number one, because we've got to do both Trinity Lutheran and the Supreme Court's rulings on Trump's executive order, the so-called Muslim ban, and three in-depth cases this week, I think is just, you know, mental overload for our listeners. And number two, as far as I can tell, Nawaz has not yet filed that lawsuit. And so the longer we can put it off, the greater the chance there is that I can see what he's actually done, or if he's actually planning to do something that's, you know, part of the analysis. But so we're going to handle that next week.
Yeah.
Keep listening to the show.
Too much good stuff. Just too much good stuff. But it's good. Yeah, that is a more timeless issue. I know a lot of people were asking about it right away, but I think that's a good strategy move, Andrew, to talk about the stuff that...
Oh, I was just going to say, and we're also going to do the law of the 4th of July on the 4th of July.
Perfect.
So you can't ask for more timely than that. And that should be a lot of fun.
Well, that's next Tuesday. Let's get to now. This is now.
With our, we'll do the scene from Spaceballs.
Yeah, exactly. So let's get to our question today.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
And for our question, Andrew, we've got a bit of a spin. Now, it is a listener question, but it's an extra special, amazing bonus listener question that we're going to tackle on this show. So as you guys probably know, we took on a bunch of listener questions, but from patrons over on the super secret for everybody's eyes but Andrew post over on patreon.com/law. And we took as many of those as we could get to. And Andrew and I answered some of them that were kind of casual, not law based, but we answered them and it was a really fun recording. I loved that recording. I thought it was great. And it was about an hour long, and that was all extra bonus to thank our amazing patrons. But what we wanted to do is just give you a little taste of what that was. So we're going to answer one that we didn't get to. All right. So now the goal here was for you to fail a bunch of questions like I did with the bar exam. So it'd be kind of turning the tables on you. People will have to go check out the patron Q&A to see if that's what happened. I won't spoil it. But here we go. Here's another go. Surprise question. Garrett Thomas Fox, the Liberaltarian. Interesting. Okay, ooh. That's one of our... So he's not quite Dan the conservative man, but he's Garrett Thomas Fox, the Liberaltarian. person. Parenting question. That sounds like you can't get this one wrong, but we'll see.
Or it sounds like I can only get this wrong.
What is the best thing you think you did for your kid to help him think critically? Follow up, would you ever suggest your child to be an attorney? That's a good question.
Let me tackle both of those. My son is 14, so I hope I've been a good parent. I'm super proud of him. But, you know, you always second guess yourself. And I think I'll do that, till the day I die. I'm proud of a lot of things that I'm mostly proud of Alex, of how he has grown up and the way in which he approaches the world. What I think I did to try and inculcate a critical thinking mindset is sort of two things. The first is I have always been very, very willing to look at Alex when he's asked a question, even when he was very, very young, and say, I don't know the answer to that. Let's go look that up, right? Let's go find out the answer.
And I can't wait to do that. I really can't. Yeah. it's just such a different time. I mean, I'm a little younger than you, even from me to my however old my kids will be, is going to be such a different time. Because when you grew up, people would just say crap and you had no way of knowing what was right. People would have all these dumb wives' tales about what to, you know, how to cure something or what does the, and it's such a difference now to be able to just say, hey, magical machine, tell me the perfect right answer to everything. Right. If you know how to do it. Now, of course, obviously, this didn't solve all the world's problems because a lot of people don't know. And you know, information isn't that simple. It's hard to know what the right sources are, and it's hard to, you know. But still, I'm very much looking forward to that. I think that's a great answer because I can't wait to just be like, I don't know, look it up. Like, Google it right now. Now, stop what you're doing. Find the answer to that. How many stars are there or whatever? I don't know. Some random question.
Yeah, no, with all of those. And related to that, you know, we always had a policy in the house of, once you do what we ask, then we'll answer any question, right? And that was because, you know, to stop the, you know, 3-year-old in the middle of the street going, well, why do I have to get out of the street? Well, because a truck is going to run you over. Get out of the damn middle of
because so, of the... Oh. Yeah, that doesn't really work.
So the rule was always, if I tell you to do something and you do it, then you can ask any question about why did I ask you to do that, you know, and I'll sit down and explain it to you. And I tried to be really, really good with that. Like everybody has that experience from childhood of like, when I'm a parent, I am never going to do, you know, because dad said so.
Please tell me, though, you're criticizing Alex's cross-examination skills, though. Never ask a question you don't know the answer to, son.
In terms of whether I would encourage him to be an attorney, I mean, you know, obviously I would encourage him to pursue whatever interest he has. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have legal interests right now, which I'm okay with. I want to answer that a little bit more broadly because I get questions from listeners a lot on, hey, I'm thinking about law school, you know, XYZ. And I would say the current status where we have 150 accredited law schools in the country pumping out tens of thousands of law school graduates every year makes it really, really difficult. In particular, you don't get a huge price break on the bottom end of that scale. So, you know, the world in which if you got a law degree, you know, you were pretty well guaranteed to go off and get a good paying job once you graduate. Like that world has changed. And there are folks with honors degrees from good schools who are, you know, working as paralegals and contract attorneys and not recouping the cost on their law school investment. So, you know, what I would say is if you're thinking about law school, please do a couple of things, right? Number one, know what you want to do as a lawyer, right? Like, you know, I kind of did this the wrong way, right? Like I didn't know, you know, I mean, we talked about, you know, this is common with both of us, right? Like,
yeah,
I just kind of came out of college and went to law school because I thought that's, you know, sort of what smart people did. And it worked out. But part of the reason it worked out is because the cost of college and law school, I came out of college with very little debt. And I actually still have one student student loan that I haven't paid off yet. So, you know, but those costs have just skyrocketed since then. And it's really, really hard. And there are a lot of people that, you know, sort of are like, I like listening to the show and I'm interested in politics.
I'm kicking Thomas's ass on the bar exam. Right. I bet I could definitely.
Exactly. And I would say, you know, before you go to law school, like, know what you want to do with the law. Get a sense of the law schools that you can go into. You know, I mean, just sort of do your homework. And because I would hate to see, you know, folks sort of saddled with a lot of debt that because our educational system is broken. And I won't pick which one, but one of our major political parties has decided to pretend like that's not a thing. So that's a little bit of a bummer of an ender.
Well, that's a good answer, but I regret to say it wasn't the right answer. I'm sorry. Ooh. You are 0-for-1 on the bar exam today, Andrew. Gosh.
Okay.
That's a 0%, just so you know. Done the math. That's... So close. I think you analyzed the question correctly.
Is my second chance parenting license still intact?
Yeah. And I could answer this question as regards my cats, but I feel like I don't want to embarrass you by answering it better. So I'll just not.
Yeah.
I'll just
not. That's fair. Your cats are very skeptical, Mr. Kitty.
Yeah. Yeah, they're very skeptical of anything I say, to the point of it's almost like they're not even listening. Like, that's how skeptical they are. Great question. There were so many good questions in that thread. It was really fun. We did something that I think is one of my favorite things about this show, which is start to craft like an actual movie plot that could work for a law movie. You know, we're not going to give you the details. That's for the Patreon feed. But that's a really fun thing to do. And we did that a couple times with some of the questions. So definitely check it out. It was great. All right. Joining us now is Andrew Seidel. So glad to have you here, Andrew. We got two Andrews. This is impossible. Never mind. We can't do it. Hang up, everybody. No, how's it going, Andrew?
Oh, I've been better, but I really appreciate the opportunity to come on your podcast.
Oh, thanks for coming on. It's a pleasure to have you. We're going to talk today about Trinity Lutheran. And I know this is something that Andrew covered in detail, but it also didn't necessarily go the way Andrew thought. So I can't wait to get your thoughts if you had the same impression.
Well, I think I probably did before oral argument. Before oral argument, I thought the case was very clear. And then I listened to oral argument and I said it was going to come down 7-2 the wrong way. And I hated being right so much on that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Remind me, Andrew Torres, did we cover this before oral argument or after?
Yeah, we covered it before oral argument, and in full disclosure, I predicted off the briefs that if Gorsuch was seated by the time the case was heard, that it would be 6-3 in favor of the good guys. So that's a pretty big swing. And the reason for that, that I really sort of want to drill down on is I have a belief that has now been shaken as an appellate litigator. I've never argued before the Supreme Court, but I have argued before various circuit courts of appeal, predominantly in the Fourth Circuit. But I've also been admitted pro hoc in the First, Third, and one case in the 11th Circuit. It's kind of weird. And so my belief is that these cases are won and lost on the briefs, and that particularly at the Supreme Court level, that a lot gets made out of oral argument, but that the law doesn't typically get made at oral argument. Mm. So I was stunningly wrong on this one. I'd be happy to kind of go into, you know, my details on why I think that as a general principle. But since we have Andrew Seidel on, I'd love to hear sort of what I've got some ideas given the unique procedural history in this case. But Andrew, why don't you take it over?
Well, I mean, I think you're probably generally right on that point. And as you said, and I think this is, you know, we should defend you a little bit here because the facts really kind of did change a little bit right before oral argument in very important ways that affected the oral argument. And I think actually, and this is what you're getting at, Andrew, surprisingly, the outcome of the case. It was actually very, very frustrating to watch being... You know, I work at the Freedom From Religion Foundation. This is what we do. You know, we submitted an amicus brief in this case, but we weren't a party. We were on the brief with the ACLU and Americans United. And, you know, we're basically on the sidelines watching this happen. And it's so frustrating because any one of our groups could have done an infinitely better job arguing this case for the side that says, yeah, hey, the government can't give money to a church, period. So it was a really frustrating experience. Do we need to talk about the facts and everything for everybody?
Well, Andrew went way through it months ago, but this was the one where it was a program to put chewed up tire crap in a playground, right?
Right.
and so the question was, there was in the procedures for that program, I think they were not going to count churches. Or they were not. They were going to score them lower. How was it? I don't remember.
Yeah, they just struck the churches from the program.
Oh, okay. They just struck the churches from the program. And so the question was, and I know Andrew took me through both the briefs, I guess, like both the arguments from each side. And at first, I thought one was convincing, and then he went through the other one, and that seemed convincing. But ultimately, it seemed like it was reasonable that you wouldn't have to. The government wouldn't be required to spend money, or the government would be allowed to say, we're not going to include church playgrounds in this program. But I'm sure I'm forgetting a lot of the relevant details.
No, I think that's exactly right. And Andrew, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that was pretty right on. I think the majority would definitely agree with that summation too. But to me, you know, the most important fact in the case was left out of the majority opinion, you know, and it is the fact that the church uses this, it's called the Trinity Lutheran Learning Center. That's where the playground is situated. It's at their learning center, and the learning center serves as a ministry of that church. It is a ministry directed at children. So it's directed at solidifying the faith of kids as young as 2 years old who are already in the church, and directed at pulling in other children from the community into that faith. And I mean, if you can go onto the Trinity Lutheran website today, or at least it was like this yesterday, and you can click on their ministries and click on children's ministry, and then the Learning Center is right there under that tab. And to me, that is the most important fact, and it was completely unmentioned in the majority. It was the first thing that Sotomayor and Ginsburg had in the dissent. So at least it was in there. But that is, I think, the one fact that all the listeners should keep in mind as we talk about this as well, because this is the reason this case was successful for the other side, and the reason that it went this way was because they made it into the playground case.
I was just going to add that the other thing that I wanted to add to what Thomas said to set this up is, and in my view, where this case is going to be dangerous going forward, is that Missouri has a provision in its state constitution. 37 other states have a provision that's something like this, that says that no money ever shall be taken from the public treasury, directly or indirectly, in aid of any church, sect, or denomination of religion, or in aid of any priest, preacher, minister, or teacher thereof as such, and that no preference shall be given to, nor any discrimination made, against any church, sect, or creed of religion, or any form of religious faith or worship. And you couple that with longstanding Establishment Clause jurisprudence. Thomas, you and I have gone over the Lemon versus Kurtzman test, but the third prong of the Lemon test, and you have to satisfy all three to not violate the Establishment Clause of the Constitution, is that government may not excessively entangle itself in religion.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that states have done that is, in my view, perfectly rational is they've said, look, particularly in these 38 states that have a provision in the Constitution that says don't give money to churches, they've said, look, in light of that, in light of general principles of separation of church and state that underlie the First Amendment, and in light specifically of the Lemon test of excessive entanglement for the Establishment Clause, what we're going to say is when we have discretionary programs, we just don't want churches to apply to that, because it is going to make it's almost impossible to adjudicate how a church disperses funds without excessively entangling government and religion. And up until this case, that's a perfectly permissible thing for the state to do, to say, hey, look, like, we just don't want to err on the side of accidentally giving tax dollars away to, you know, sectarian religious organizations. So the easiest thing to do is just to be like, look, these programs are government programs. They're intended for a different class of individuals. And if you're a church, you shouldn't participate in the program. And that when we did You Be the Supreme Court, we looked at a case I'm sure we're going to talk about with Andrew today, the Locke versus Davey test. And that seemed to be the overall state of the law up until earlier this week. Andrew, do I have that right? Do you anything you want to add to that or quibble on? Or
no, I think that was well said. The one thing I think I would add is the historical rationale for this, the reason that we have this in the first place, is in part to foster the free exercise of religion. You know, when the founders, when Madison was debating this back in 1785, you know, they were trying to prevent government money from flowing to churches as a way to protect the individual citizens' rights of conscience. You know, and I think we've grown so accustomed to this rule, I think that the justices kind of really made a huge mistake simply because they were so used to that. You know, we're not in 1785 anymore, where there's this history, centuries, millennia of the government being able to tax people and then send that tax revenue directly to the churches. We haven't had that for a very long time, and I think that's one of the reasons that the court made this error. But I just wanted to add that that's actually the historic rationale behind it. It's kind of important, you know. It actually fosters religious free exercise.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really good point. So we took a step back to kind of talk about the history of the case. What happened before oral argument?
What happened? How did this go so wrong?
Well, it's pretty, I mean, it's kind of fascinating what happened. So basically, Missouri got a new governor and a new attorney general. They were both Republicans, and I believe they were replacing two Democrats. So shortly before oral argument, the governor announced that Trinity Lutheran and all other churches would be able to get grants under this playground resurfacing program. So there was no longer any adversity between the parties. The attorney general was going to be the one arguing this case, and now the attorney general agrees with the church in the case. So you have the two parties agreeing with the outcome and agreeing with the major arguments in the case, which is a very... jurisdictionally, there's no reason the court should have continued to hear the case. It should have been booted to the curb on those grounds. But the court went ahead and heard the case anyway, and there was barely a mention of this lack of adversity. It only popped up in a footnote. Basically, what the court was saying in the footnote was that, well, the government could change its mind. That was essentially what they were saying. They cited one case for that. It's kind of a famous case in standing law, Laidlaw versus Friends of the Earth. But interestingly, in that case, there was actually a claim for damages. There was a claim for money, and you didn't have that here. Trinity Lutheran was never arguing that the government had to give them the money as a remedy in this case. So that case is not, and the parties actually disagreed in the Laidlaw case, I believe. So it was almost an opposite case to be citing. So in my mind, this case actually should have been dismissed as soon as the attorney general made that announcement.
Wow.
Yeah, no, I agree. And so was it your take from oral argument that that sort of the less than half-hearted defense was really what led the Supreme Court to this kind of atrocious decision?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the argument was very, very poor. And there was there's a couple of weird things that happened also early on in the case. You know, if you read the majority opinion, they say that the churches need not apply. You know, that's kind of one of the lines that was getting bandied about in the press. But that's not true, because the church did apply, and they were actually ranked. They were ranked fifth out of the 30-some playgrounds that applied that year. And they were giving out 10 grants. So if churches need not apply, how do they apply and get ranked is a question that I have, that I couldn't find the answer to that in the facts or the appendix anywhere.
To play devil's advocate, wouldn't the response there be, it doesn't do you any good if you apply, rank in the top 10, and then they throw your application away, right?
Oh, I agree with that completely. I'm getting a little paranoid, basically, is what I'm saying. I mean, I think that, you know, the dissent said that constitutional questions are decided by the court, not the party's concessions. And that was a huge point that was missed, because the parties agreed that there was no establishment clause argument to be made in the case. Huh. And that right there I mean, that gave the entire game to the church. I mean, that was it, because the Establishment Clause is what prevents, and all that whole line of cases is what prevents public money from flowing to the church. Now, you can do it under the Missouri Constitution as well, but the arguments are the same. And the majority did basically just swept aside all Establishment Clause law in favor of the Free Exercise Clause and examining this case under the Free Exercise Clause. And it really, the lack of adversity, I think, really did have a huge impact in that.
Yeah, in my view, and I guess... Maybe when we're done this section, you and I can hash it out a little bit on Establishment Clause law, because I'm not sure I disagree with the initial state's brief under Pauley that would concede we don't want to fight this on Establishment Clause grounds, because that's a harder argument, right? Like, if there's an Establishment Clause violation, what you're saying is the state has no discretion whether to include Trinity Lutheran in the recycling program. And that's a harder argument to make than the state has discretion and properly excluded. In my view, when we did the UB the Supreme Court, I think the point that where I got Thomas to agree and kind of go, well, you know, how do you square with that is the Locke v. Davy case, which it's a Supreme Court case from 2004. It involved the state of Washington, and Washington was administering various grants for scholarships. And again, like here, limited amount of money. And so, and again, like here, Washington has a provision in its state constitution that prohibits giving money directly to churches. And the state of Washington said, you know what, we're not going to allow you to be eligible for the scholarship if you are going to use that to pursue a degree in worshipful theology, I think it was, right? Mm. And the Supreme Court, 7-2, it's a Rehnquist opinion, right? Like, this is not, you know, this is not from the far left wing of the court. It's a Rehnquist opinion that says, yeah, no, it's perfectly reasonable, right? Like, the Free Exercise Clause doesn't come into play when you want money to practice your religion, right? Like, no one's ability to practice their religion is diminished in any way whatsoever by the fact that if you want to pursue a degree in worshipful theology, you can't avail yourself of limited state funds to do that by kind of rational choice here. And that seemed to me to just completely control in this case. It's why I thought the case was going to go the other way.
Well, then what happened? Does this decision like reverse that, or was it decided in a way that sidesteps that? What are the details of the opinion, I guess?
So Locke is premised on the tension between the Free Exercise Clause and the Establishment Clause. So, I mean, right. It reiterates this and kind of popularized this phrase about the religion clauses, saying that there's this play in the joints between the two. And I think, Andrew, what you're saying is that given that play in the joints, Locke allows the states to essentially be a little more stringent when it comes to Establishment Clause concerns in the state constitution.
That's exactly right.
Correct. Okay. So, I mean, I think you're right in that that's what the Supreme Court has said. I guess I disagree slightly. I don't think there's that much play in the joints, if any. I think when they come into conflict, and this is outside the bounds, but since you guys are a legal podcast, I'm going to go for it. I think that when they're in conflict, I think the Establishment Clause ought to trump, given the plain language of the clauses. I mean, if you look at the wording, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So prohibiting is a very narrow phrase, or very narrow. You know, you can burden it, you just can't prohibit it. Whereas respecting an establishment of religion is a very broad and all encompassing phrase. So I think that when the two come into conflict, really the Establishment Clause ought to be the one that wins out. But that's not what the court said in Locke. So I will agree with you there. And I think that your summation of Locke v. Davy is perfectly right on. It does say essentially that states can be a little bit more stringent when interpreting their own Establishment Clauses. And I think it should have dictated the outcome here. The reason it didn't is because the court said you basically have this, you have this free exercise right to have access to government funding. I mean, it was really an expansion that I don't think anybody was was expecting.
Except you, apparently.
Well, only, I mean, I wouldn't have guessed that it was going to do this way. I mean, I saw, the only reason I predicted it was because during oral argument, Ginsburg and Sotomayor were the only two who seemed to have any, Establishment Clause concerns, be they state or federal, in their minds at all. Yeah. Everybody else was just focusing on, this is kids, this is skinned knees, this is playground. You know, it really seemed to, there was this lack of objectivity that you typically expect from judges, especially
because the obvious
Supreme Court
answer to that is there's only, what, 10 playgrounds are going to get this anyway? Like, there's going to be skin knees somewhere. It doesn't matter, like, why.
Well, and let's just step back, because they had pea gravel on their playgrounds. I mean, the kids were not going to get hurt falling down, right? I mean, that stuff is annoying. It gets in your shoes, but, you know, it's not hurting anybody. I think they were perfectly fine the way they were. Anyway.
No, I think Thomas's rejoinder there is exactly correct, right? Like, we are talking about limited public funds. 10 playgrounds are going to get resurfaced, 27 are not. And yeah, so the talk of skin knees is, you know, I would not hesitate to call that the reddest of herrings at oral argument. To go back to Thomas's question, you said, what is the implication of this case for Locke v. Davy? And there are two answers to that, right? So the first is, Locke is still good law. What this case does is distinguish Locke. And I'm going to read to you pretty much the entire paragraph of distinction. Mm-hmm. Thomas, you and I have talked about this on the show. But, you know, when you have a prior case that goes the other way, one of the things that is common in a legal opinion is to say, yes, we recognize this case goes the other way, but it does so for this reason that's, you know, not apposite here. And for example, like, we talked about how the Maryland gun control case really sort of brilliantly distinguished out DC versus Heller on the grounds that Heller had an explicit carve out for military style weapons, right? So it was sort of seizing on that language to say, yeah, look, even Heller, you know, didn't mean to apply to ban on military style weapons, which, you know, it's clever because obviously Scalia did intend for Heller to apply in cases like that. Tell me what you think of this distinction, okay? This is from the majority. In Locke, the court made clear that it was not like the case now before us. Washington's restriction on the use of its scholarship funds was different. According to the court, the state had, quote, merely chosen not to fund a distinct category of instruction, end quote. Davy was not denied a scholarship because of who he was. He was denied a scholarship because of what he proposed to do, use the funds to prepare for the ministry. Here, there is no question that Trinity Lutheran was denied a grant simply because of what it is, a church. So how does that strike you as distinguishing Locke?
It's a distinction without a difference. And I sadly, this is going to be a rough sentence. I agree with Gorsuch on this one. He addressed this in his concurrence. I think he actually did a fairly provided some nice examples of why this is sort of an illusory distinction. And it's just not the way Locke was decided. Again, Locke was premised on the tension between the free exercise and establishment clauses.
So wait, if Gorsuch agrees with you, does that mean he thinks that Locke should be reversed? Like, how could he both agree on the, like, that distinction is wrong, but also have sided with the majority?
Yeah, well, that's exactly. And I was setting Andrew up for the fact that I really wanted to set Andrew up because in his concurrence, I think Gorsuch really lays bare the fact that that Locke v. Davy controls in this case, and that this distinction is a garbage distinction. Here's what Gorsuch says. He says, first, the court leaves open the possibility of a useful distinction that might be drawn between laws that discriminate on the basis of religious status and religious use. Respectfully, I harbor doubts about the stability of such a line. Does a religious man say grace before dinner? Or does a man begin his meal in a religious manner? Is it a religious group that built the playground? Or did a group build the playground so that it might be used to advance a religious mission? The distinction blurs in much the same way the line between acts and omissions can blur when stared at too long, leaving us to ask, for example, whether the man who drowns by awaiting the incoming tide does so by act, coming upon the sea, or omission, allowing the sea to come to him. And look, he's right. But Thomas, you are also 100% correct that because Gorsuch is a thoroughgoing originalist in the mold of Scalia, he's just slavering to overrule Locke v. Davy, right? Mm. Like that's the whole point of writing his concurrence. He says, I agree with the majority. I disagree in two respects. And the first is they distinguish Locke v. Davy and say it's a good rule. And I would say it's a bad rule. That's clear you have a vote to overrule Locke v. Davy.
I want to do a quick aside about Gorsuch and originalism, because I think he actually gives the game away here. Right. I mean, he in this decision, he's admitting that he's basically a regressive masked in this, you know, originalist label. I mean, any true originalist would have touched on first the federalism concerns, which Locke v. Davy allow. You know, they allow a state to be a little bit more stringent when it comes to not funding religion. That's the play in the joints. That's the tension between the free exercise and the establishment clause that Locke v. Davy allows. It's there in part for these federalism concerns. It allows the state to pursue its own versions of state-church separation. And second to Gorsuch not being an originalist, he, and so did the majority, they completely ignored the extensive history of disestablishment that I think that Sotomayor did a great job of laying out in her dissent. And there's simply no way for a genuine originalist to uphold taxpayer funds going from the state to a house of worship. So I just wanted to point out that the inanity of using that phrase. Not that
we are
being inanity.
Always fans. We're always fans of pointing out how ridiculous originalism is on
okay.
this
show. Yeah, okay, good.
No, I'm glad you jumped in. I want to point out we did not script or coordinate that. Andrew, you may not know this, but in the weeks leading up to the Gorsuch confirmation hearings, I advanced the argument that has been contested from some sort of on our side in the skeptic community and in sort of more liberal circles. My argument is that Scalia style originalism, as professed by Gorsuch, is naked right-wing judicial activism, that there is
absolutely
zero concern, and that the biggest thing is, right, that we are utterly untethered by precedent. And so, you know, that's why I was pointing out, you know, you can, you know, literally like the cartoon wolf in the Woody Woodpecker cartoons. I mean, you can see Gorsuch just dripping with excitement to want to overrule Locke v. Davy.
Guys, I hate to say
13
it,
years old.
We're out of time. is there anything to try to?
Yeah, let's
quickly...
get a good wrap up from Andrew. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to talk so much.
Oh my gosh! I feel like we barely scratched the surface. Yeah. We didn't even talk about all the ridiculous opinions they tried to use. I mean, the whole case is a crux of nonsense. You know, this is a law that does not benefit religion. That's not the same as a law that deliberately prohibits religion. You know, and the majority cited Lukumi a lot, which the whole opinion is bad from start to finish. You know, I think the thing that everybody really, really just needs to keep in mind, and the thing that to me is scary about this opinion, is that this is really not about discrimination. It's not about kids' skinned knees. You know, this is about churches getting all the benefits of state church separation and accepting none of the burdens that come along with that. You know, attached to the benefits of the, there are some burdens, you know, mostly that the taxpayers will not fund your religion. And Trinity Lutheran changes that. It's not about equality, which is what they've argued. It's about giving the benefits of state church separation to churches, but none of the burdens. It's about giving churches special treatment. They get to have their cake, which now the American taxpayers pay for, and eat it too. It's an incredibly frustrating thing to see happen, and the implications, I'm scared of the implications. It's a very sad day for the First Amendment, in my opinion.
Well, I agree with that. Andrew, I want you to scare our listeners a little more. You work for the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Right now, there's no doubt in my mind the Alliance Defending Freedom, the ACLJ, and the sort of pro-integrationist groups that are trying to tear down the wall of separation between church and state are meeting and rejoicing over this decision, probably over cups of grape juice. And so my question to you is, what's next? Where is the next battle line? What are those groups? How are they going to try and capitalize on this victory to advance their cause of merging government and religion? And then what can we do to fight it?
they're going to try to kill public education. They're going to try to use vouchers to kill public education. You know, footnote 3 was kind of famous already in this opinion, because it was where the majority was supposed to sort of say that this case is only about resurfacing of playgrounds and nothing else. They don't address any of the other possible issues. But the day after the decision, they sent 4 voucher cases back down to the lower courts to reinterpret in light of Trinity Lutheran v. Comer. They're going to use this to try to rip open voucher law and just drink from the spigot of federal funds. And in the process, take that money away from public schools. That is wow. The big fight that you are going to see happen. I'm very scared for it. It's one of the things that we were most concerned about. I know a lot of the other groups are as well.
And jeez. Is there anything we can do? find a deep dark hole?
No, I mean, I would encourage everybody to, if you are able, donate to the FFRF, donate to the ACLU, donate to Americans United. I mean, you know, basically churches get all the federal funds they want now. I mean, that's they're going to be their argument. And we're still relying on the generosity of folks. So if you can, please help us out. We certainly need it. And we also need people to be members, because when people join these groups, you know, when I write a letter explaining why a constitutional violation needs to stop, if I can write it on behalf of 1,000 members or 10,000 members or 20,000 members, right now we have 30,000 members, which is great. But the more we have, the more power we have to stop these violations without having to take things to court, which, you know, there are so many. We have 7 attorneys on staff, and we get over 5,000 complaints about state church issues every year. So you can do the math on that. It's not sustainable. So if we can do this without going to court, we like to. So we depend on the generosity of good Americans to do that.
Jeez. Yeah. Highly recommend, because this is scary stuff. Well, with that, unfortunately, we're out of time. I know there's a lot more we could have talked about, but that's going to have to be it. Maybe we can follow up later on down the road. But thanks so much, both Andrews, for taking us through that.
Really, Andrew, are you willing to come back sometime, hopefully?
Yeah, I'd love to do that, absolutely. I mean, I didn't get to share my favorite, one of my favorite Ben Franklin quotes that I think is particularly applicable here, too. Yeah, I'd be willing to come back anytime you guys want to talk about this stuff.
Excellent.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Andrew.
It was my pleasure.
Down. The law. Down. The law. Down. The law. Down. The law. Andrew, another bit of big news. Boy, it was a big news week. We've got a couple Supreme Court decisions, and I'm curious to see if this went kind of the way you thought, or if it went the way you thought, but for different reasons. What's going on with the travel ban, Andrew? What's the status of that?
Yeah, so procedurally, here's what happened. We have discussed in length, we have discussed in depth the rulings by the Fourth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit in staying the implementation of Trump's Executive Order 13780, which is the so-called Muslim ban. We've talked about that extensively. Those cases were consolidated and appealed to the Supreme Court. And as a part of that process, the government asked the Supreme Court to stay the enforcement of the Fourth and Ninth Circuit opinions. And so staying those opinions would then undo the TRO that was upheld by those courts and
right.
permit the EO to go into effect.
Now, if I remember right, wasn't this one where it's like it kind of all depended on where the burden was, you were thinking? Like,
yeah.
If the burden's on, you know, Trump, then it might be a different story. And so if I remember right on this, the burden would have been on the government, right? So
that's exactly right. Yeah.
I'm curious
because
what happened.
They are now. Yeah. They are now moving to stay. And just remember, however deep you go, right, the party that's moving for the stay is going to bear the burden of proof, and they are going to bear the burden of proof on those 4 injunctive relief factors that we have talked about before, where the primary determinant in a case like this is going to be establishing a likelihood of success on the merits. So what do we have? We have a per curiam opinion of the Supreme Court. Per curiam means that it is unsigned. There are no dissents to that opinion. There are no dissents that are opposed to enjoining the and staying the Fourth and Ninth Circuit opinions in at least in part. And I'm going to talk about that, about what the Supreme Court did.
So what that means is there's no justices there's nobody said, that wants yeah. keep the stay on the ban.
Correct.
Okay.
Okay.
It's a little confusing.
Right. There is a concurrent. Yeah, no, I appreciate that because I didn't say that very eloquently. There is a Thomas Alito Gorsuch concurrence and dissent in part because what the per curiam opinion does is keep intact the injunctive relief in the Ninth Circuit opinion with respect to any individual or entity that has a bona fide relationship with a particular person seeking to enter the country as a refugee. And so that where there is a direct connection. So this goes beyond, right? You remember the problem with the first executive order was that it
wasn't very specific. It didn't tell you like which class of people were affected, right?
Right. And folks who had a pre-existing right to return to this country were included, and therefore they had standing to raise, among other things, the habeas corpus and due process issues. That was changed in EO2, but what and we talked about how the Ninth Circuit really focused on the specifics of the second executive order, which is 13780. The Supreme Court, the per curiam opinion, calls them EO1 and EO2. So I adopted a little bit of that language, even though the language we have used has been to refer to them by number. Anyway, one of the things that the Ninth Circuit points out is that the injunction covers applicants in the refugee process who have a connection to an American individual or entity, right? That is, their applications are pending, but they have a higher expectation of success because, right, they're not just sort of applying for refugee status out of nowhere. They're already sponsored to come into this country. And so it leaves intact, which is to say it bans the application of EO 13780 to that class of individuals, right? But that's a pretty narrow class of individuals. Yeah. Everything else, the EO is in effect as of today, right? And it is important to realize that the dissent, the concurrence and dissent by Thomas Alito and Gorsuch says, obviously, we would just grant a stay as to the whole of the Fourth and Ninth Circuit, right? So, you know, it's got to be. It's exactly what you would expect from
them, yeah. I have lots of questions.
Yep.
First off, does the fact that it was a 90-day thing mean that the, like, do they already need to renew the EO, or is that just a formality anyway? Or is it just since it went into effect? I mean, does that factor in at all? I don't know.
Yeah, and the answer to that is the original effective date of Executive Order 13780 was March 16th, right? Mm-hmm. So 90 days from that is June 14th, which is to say would make the case moot. So while this was pending, Trump issued a memorandum to executive branch officials. That memorandum declared the effective date of the enjoined provisions of Executive Order 13780 to be the date on which the injunctions in these cases, quote, are lifted or stayed with respect to that provision.
Okay.
So
it's in effect for 90 days from essentially now or whenever
the issuance of the opinion, right, on June 26th. 2017. So 3 days before people are hearing this.
Okay. So I had other questions. I heard some amount of coverage on this. I'm wondering if it was good coverage or the kind of coverage that sometimes we criticize, that it wasn't just a person, like a connection to a person. It was also a connection to an entity. And also combined with that, someone I heard on a podcast was talking about how ambiguous this is going to be. And I wanted to get your take on that. Do you find this language to be ambiguous? Like, what is a connection to a person or an entity? Like, they said, like, well, what about if I have a hotel reservation? Like, that's a kind of a connection to an entity in America, you know, like, what are the limits of that? What do you think about all that?
Yeah, I think that is grasping at straws. Mm. I don't think this is difficult to understand and parse out. Connection is clearly in connection with the refugee process. And again, I'm not a refugee lawyer, but my understanding is that as a part of that process, it is typical for an individual seeking asylum or refugee status to be sponsored by a person or organization in this country. And so that is clear
within that what it has a very clear meaning.
Yes.
Okay. Well, there you go. That's why we covered it here.
And again, remember the bulk of these applications are not refugee applications, right? They are visa applications, and the exception does not apply at all to visa.
So applications. Just to make sure I understand that, does that mean the ban is fully in effect for all visa applicants from these countries?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wasn't sure if I like got that inside out and it was the other way, but
yep. No, you got it. Okay. You got it exactly right. So it's a small provision. And I think the folks who are arguing to the contrary are engaged in some motivated reasoning.
Yeah. Well, it was right away. I wonder if they just weren't able to digest the information fast enough. And because that's it. I'm glad we've cleared that up. So it sounds like your very considered opinion is that it's not vague. It's at all that connection language is within that very specific application for refugee status and all that. So interesting. Good to know. Anything else we need to know about this?
Yeah. Well, what this tells you is the Supreme Court was not the slightest bit moved by the First Amendment religious discrimination city of Hialeah.
Kind of like you said.
And I got moved along the way, but this is a reminder that those are tough arguments. The per curiam opinion does not cite that, right? But let me break down. But I'm not overly surprised by that either, right? So remember that what you have here. This is a very, very short. We're going to link it on the show notes. You can read the opinion for yourself, and anybody who's been a long time opening arguments listener is going to understand this opinion pretty easily. The Supreme Court has ruled that the government has established a likelihood of success on the merits of its argument that Executive Order 13780 is constitutional. Right. Now, that does not prevent the appellants in this case, in both the Fourth and Ninth Circuit cases, from arguing that it is unconstitutional, but
indication that they wouldn't grant cert?
Yeah, we've seen the punchline, right? Yeah. Like it. I mean, it is to say, the Supreme Court will still grant cert on the merits,
okay.
Right? That's already been done, right? Because in order to stay the effect,
a separate thing from this. Okay,
no,
sorry,
they did not. So they granted cert on the merits of reviewing the Fourth and Ninth Circuit cases. They have not ruled on the merits of the Fourth and Ninth Circuit cases, but they have stayed the effect of the Fourth and Ninth Circuit cases pending that review because, in the Supreme Court's view, the government is likely to prevail on the merits. I have never seen, I know it has happened, but I have never been involved with or seen or heard of any of my friends losing on a motion to stay the effect of a judgment and then turning
later
around and winning on the merits and convincing the court, no, you looked at this too quickly and in fact, you should change your mind.
That's pretty big news because, you're essentially
really
saying the Supreme Court has done what you kind of said initially, which is they don't see any merit to the First Amendment argument. Most likely, in all likelihood. And that really tells us a lot going forward about what Trump can do, right?
Yes. Yes, it does.
Yeah. And it's also interesting to note, again, that this was unanimous, right? I mean, you mentioned there was the concurrent opinion or whatever. There's a slightly different, obviously, the slightly different opinion. But in terms of the blanket question of, is this order likely going to be found constitutional? Essentially, unanimously, they said yes.
Yeah, that's right. Now, keep in mind, if you want crumbs to hold on to, you can find some crumbs to hold on to, right? So a per curiam opinion is, right, like Bush v. Gore was a per curiam opinion. It's the kind of thing the Supreme Court issues when it says we really are not confident here and we don't want future lawyers to look back and cite this case. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it sends that kind of a signal. There is language with respect to considering the argument about likelihood of success on the merits that says, you know, now, mind you, we've made a determination, but that does not conclusively resolve the rights of the parties. So, you know, look, if you want to delude yourself into thinking that that there's good news, you can do that. But I think that's not the right way to yeah. read this opinion. This tells you where it's going, and it sort of resets everything back to where we were in August of 2016, when the very first time we talked about this, we talked about this as an incredibly unlikely proposition, which we thought at the time. But I think it's pretty clear that the Supreme Court is going to come down and say, yeah, the president has the power to do this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, elections have consequences. Yep. I'll say it again. Original with me. I don't know who else you think said that. But obviously original to me.
No, it was it's a granite bust of Andrew's head. And it says elections have that's the meme that everyone knows, associates. Memes are always true. Like,
people who are surprised, again, you know, I will just reiterate politically, Donald Trump stuck by this policy when he dropped in the polls in the Republican primary, right? Like when he first said, we're going to have a ban on Muslims, he went from 38 to like 29. Wow. And then, you know, was in a position to win Iowa and lost Iowa. And if he stuck with it then, why would you expect him to abandon it when he won, right? Like the logic of people trying to decipher President Trump continues to surprise me. But
yeah, there's a lot of wishful thinking going on, I think.
Yeah.
So, but, there you go.
There we go. It's bad, terrible news. If you, if you're pro Trump and you're one of those three people listening to us, then it's probably great news for you. But in any event, we're going to continue to tell you what we think.
Hold on. If you are pro Trump and you listen to the show, email me. I really want to talk to you.
Yeah,
I really do. Thomas@seriouspod.com. Not even joking. Yeah. Email me if you're pro Trump. Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, please do that. And we'll get him on the show.
Yeah, I would love to.
So we will continue to tell you our actual assessment of the law and what we think is likely to happen. You heard a huge, you know, I really, really misjudged where I thought the Supreme Court would go on Trinity Lutheran versus Cohen.
Yeah.
But again, all I can do is try and tell you what, how things look from my vantage point.
Well, from my vantage point, you're always right. And sometimes those dastardly Supreme Court justices are wrong. So that's,
thank you, Thomas. I appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for breaking that down. Bad news, but, you know, we got to deal with reality on reality's terms.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
It's time for my least favorite part of the week. It is Thomas takes the bar exam. Oh, and now I'm going to be further embarrassed by another attorney taking the question.
No, I'm gonna join you in your embarrassment. Okay. Fear not.
Well, for the sanctity of the game, Andrew, don't chime in until I give my answer, because I can't have any help. But but after I give my answer, you can tell me how wrong I am. I can't wait.
So welcome to the first, and as far as I can tell, unless Andrew Seidel comes back on the show, the only edition of Thomas and Andrew take the bar exam. Question number 30. So here we go. A teenage male was on trial on charges of illegally entering an owner's property and stealing a car. The witness can only confirm for the prosecution that a car was stolen, the model and type of car, and that it was missing from the property on a date certain. The defense asks the witness, isn't it possible that my client did not steal the car, that someone else did it, and that the police are lying about the charges against him? The prosecution objected to the question. Will the court likely sustain the objection? Okay. So this is a question about the admissibility of a question asking, isn't it possible that my client did not steal the car on cross-examination of the prosecution's witness? Your options are A, Yes, because this is an objectionable question based on pure speculation. B, yes, because it is not permissible to question the credibility of the police without substantial supporting evidence. C, no, questioning about the possibility of other perpetrators or about police misconduct is always permissible. Or D, no, because the witness may know something that he is not revealing, and for that reason, a cross-examiner is given wide latitude in questioning. All right. Oh,
man, this is going to be so hard because I think my mind is just clouded with all the bad examples of objections from TV shows and movies. Objection. And then there's always the just objection with no specification on what the objection is. Like, is that, can we just do that here? Objection.
No,
okay.
And no ruling, no instruction to the jury.
Just, you just say objection. That happens a lot on TV. Oh, man. All right. So I'm going to try to eliminate my two, see if I'm good for that. I think there's a lot of here. I think C is a good one to eliminate because there's that language of always and all that. So no, C was no questioning, questioning about the possibility of other perpetrators is always permissible. I think that's got to be wrong. Oh, man. What else can I eliminate? Let's see. Not permissible. I feel like I also want to eliminate D, no, because the witness may know something that he is not revealing, and for that reason, a cross-examiner is given wide latitude in questioning. That just sounds wrong to me. I hope that's a good elimination, but I'm going to eliminate C and D, and I'm looking at a yes answer. So between A and B, which one seems... It seems like this is pure speculation. I'm just going to go with A. I'm going to hope it's the simple answer. Yes, because this is an objectionable question based on pure speculation. That's my final. I'm going with A.
All right. Andrew?
Now, Andrew, how'd I do?
Your thoughts.
My initial thought is I'm so glad I'm not a criminal trial attorney. That's nice. I'd also, just for all the listeners out there, I actually graded bar exams for a while. And, you can fail. You can miss like half the points and still easily pass the bar exam.
So people should be aware of it. That was my plan.
Well, I'm not kidding. Like, it's worth knowing because if you're taking a two-day exam, it's a little demoralizing after the first day, especially, a lot of people who go to law school are really used to acing, all their exams. They're not used to having a problem. And you walk out of there, thinking that you might have missed, 30% of the questions, or you were unsure on half of them, and you don't realize you can miss half those points.
I think what you're saying is you're setting me up for a soft landing on my totally wrong answer. Go ahead.
No, I know. I'm going to agree with you. Actually, I'll take A as well.
Wow.
But like I said, we're wrong. So you should.
So you're agreeing with me, but you're setting us both up for being wrong, yes. And that's okay. All right, I love
correct.
It. Well, did you want to give any insight into your reasoning, or you just want to go with A?
No, I'm just going to go with A.
Oh, okay. Well, it's a multiple choice test. All you have to do is just check the box, so sure.
Yeah, yeah. You can get half wrong, so just go fast.
There we go. So we'll have to find out next week who was right, me or...
Oh, you'll get to
wait.
Know?
No, hold on. You'll get to know next week. Okay, let you know in a secret. For you, it'll be in like a minute, but for everybody else, it'll be next week. So definitely play along as always. Tell us whether you think the experts on the show, me and Andrew Seidel, whether or not we got the question right, or you can guess a different answer and play along with TTTBE. And now's the time where we've got it. It is, I don't know if we ever mentioned this, but it is one of our favorite days. That is Top Patron Hall of Fame Patron Friday. I love it.
That's right. And so thank you to Roger Metcalf's package weighs more. Sorry. Thank you to Roger Metcalf's package weighs more than Black's Law Dictionary. That's spectacular. Thank you, Roger. Danny Rosari, Eli Bosnick, Dave Nichols of Positively Doubtful Podcast, Steve Sickman, Jim Grove, Amanda Lipnack, Heather Loveridge, Geeker 41, Sean Pitty, Ian and Allie, Matthew Vernon, Violet Page Hall, Heath Enright, Jeffrey Maynor, The Wayward Willis, Detective Matthew Maxson, Dave Lovely, Danny Baker at Combat Nonsense, Sharon Frankel, host of the delightful podcast Habeas Humor. I was just on the delightful podcast Habeas Humor. Squickthinger, Ian Ryan, Matthew Hillier, Aaron Grady, Brandon Smith, TV is My Girlfriend, C6 Sarah, Hunter Ash, and Torsten Skurve. Thank you all so much for being Hall of Fame patrons.
Absolutely. And thank you to Adopt a Homeless Pet and Oppose Declawing and Ear Dogging, Philip Stromberg, You Are Here Sci-Fi Audio Drama, RJ Guardian Ad Litem Pete. Oh my God.
It would be pronounced Guardian Ad Litem Pedes Absentis.
Okay. So. That. Ratio. Oh, Legalize the purge. That's a legal question for you. Stephen Boyd at DJ Empirical, campquest.org, 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 Torsten Peel of prosperitycomrade.org and placebomart.com. JT also loves Dungeons and Dragons. Soggy Pants, Sammy, Carl, Zipple, Squaring the Strange Podcast, Sam Dunow, please use this spot to promote a cause of your choosing. Well, how about I promote your cause? I promote your wonderful patronage. Greg Sullivan, Garrett Thomas Fox, The Libertarian. There you go. You heard his question today. Malika Chandler, John Bodley, Terry Pratchett really is great. Kaylee Reiser, Sakashite Fukusumi, Michael Schaefer of Reason Real Estate, the Electronic Frontier Foundation at EFF.org, the NetSec Heathen, Jessica Wilson, Mark Smith, Thomas McCormick, Dan Griffith, Frederick Elstromer, Reven, Michael Rops, Conrad Michaels, and Zabby. Boy, it's very pleasing to know that list is getting really long. Thank you guys for supporting and making the show happen. I hope you enjoy.
Could always be twice as long, though.
I hope you enjoy Lot Awful Movies number 8, sort of featuring Ishmael Brown from Angry Black Rant. You'll have to hear it to hear that story. and of course, the patron Q&A that we talked about. All right, so bar question would go here, and then we can just do another ending now and just do it better. Yep. All right, that's it for today's show. A huge thanks to Andrew Seidel. Really cool to finally speak to him. And thanks, of course, to Andrew for being our expert week in, week out. And thanks most of all to our patrons at patreon.com/law. Hope you enjoy that bonus content. Thank you, listeners. We will see you next week.
Bye.
Stop breaking the law!
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it'd be a big help if you could leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC. All rights reserved.